God loves us by doing everything he has to do at great cost to himself, to remove every obstacle from inside of us and inside of him, to bring us to the place where we enjoy him, which makes much of him.
What does God's love for us look like? That's the question John Piper answers in this episode of Light and Truth. This message was originally given in Phoenix, Arizona at the Desiring God 2006 Regional Conference.
I want to understand the nature of the love of God for me. Because here I am going around the country and writing stuff, arguing that God, in all that he does, exalts himself for your enjoyment. And there are folks who don't like that picture of God. It feels like he's a megalomaniac. So I have asked myself, what is it to be loved? What does it mean biblically to be loved? And I think right at this point, we hit our culture about as broadside as we can hit it. Because what the culture means by being loved, at least at the surface level, is the opposite of what the Bible means by being loved. So let me tell you what I think those two are, and then take you to John chapter 11. The world, I think, by and large, feels love. Now, when I say the world, I mean unregenerate human beings. They have not been born again. They are natural. They think without God at the center. Their affections have not been awakened. They are dead spiritually, according to Ephesians 2:5. And being dead spiritually, the spiritual things of God are foolishness to them, and they have no categories for handling much biblical truth, especially this one. So, for the unregenerate American or any other human being, to be loved is to be made much of. I feel really loved by you if you make much of me. Praise me, thank me, applaud me, compliment me. Just build up my ego. Give me some, help me with my self-esteem. Everybody likes it, and so it works. It works. That's what it means to be loved. Love people means to make them feel significant. Now, will you try to add that or use that as the means by which God loves us? It won't work. Biblical love from God to us keeps God at the center, not us. So here's my definition of the way God loves us. God loves us by doing everything he has to do at great cost to himself, to remove every obstacle from inside of us and inside of him, to bring us to the place where we enjoy him, which makes much of him. Just like we saw in Philippians 1, 20 and 21. When you enjoy him, you magnify him. And God's way of loving you is to strip you, if he must, of every substitute satisfaction so that you can have the best one, himself. Being stripped of every vain satisfaction so that, like a snake, you have your skin ripped off is painful. But when it's done and you see God, as the magnificent soul satisfier that he is, you know, I have been loved. John chapter 11 goes like this. Now a certain man, we're in verse 1, was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill, which means this relationship is precious between Mary and Martha and Jesus and Lazarus. Verse 3. So the sister sent to him saying, Lord, he whom you love. Now mark that word love, because that's what I'm after here. What does love mean? He whom you love is ill. And her thought, of course, is, you're going to come fix this quick. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God. Now mark that word, because I want to know how love and glory relate to each other. That's what I'm after. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Verse 5. Now Jesus loved. So there it is again. You cannot get away. That's what this text is about. It's about love. It's about glory. How do they relate? Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And then I hope the version of the Bible that you have in your lap begins verse 6 with something like the word therefore or so. If it says but, you need a new version. Because the word is un in Greek, and everybody knows what un means. First year Greek students, it means therefore. Translated in my version, so. That's fine. So means therefore in English. So, because he loves them, see that? Let's get the connection. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Mary because he, therefore, since he loved them, when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer where he was. We saw a text from John last night that blew us away, in John 7, where the brothers wanted him to go do his works because they didn't believe in him. And John's always doing things to break our brain. And here, he says, I love them. I love Martha. I love Mary. I love Lazarus. Lazarus is very sick and on the point of death, so I'm not going to go. So I'm not going to go. So I'm not going to go. Therefore, I'm not going to go. Now, how do you make sense of the therefore in verse 6? And the answer is verse 4. If this were a seminar, I'd have you take a test and say, explain from verse 4 the therefore of verse 6. Because verse 4 says, this illness that I'm going to let kill him, I'm staying here 2 days longer to make sure he's dead when I get there. That's what he's saying. This illness is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God, that's me, the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now, how would you paraphrase this? I would paraphrase it like this. To love is to do whatever you have to do, even at the cost of your brother's life, to reveal to you the glory of God. That's just what it says. It's just, what else can you do with it? I'm not going to go heal him. I'm going to let him die so that you will see the glory of God, because I love you. I love you. I will not spare you one of the most horrible things in life. This poor guy has got to die twice. And you're going to be grieving for 3 or 4 days, weeping your eyes out. And I know all that. I'm causing all of that by not going now. Why? Verse 5 says, because I love you. because I love you. And a spared brother is not what love is about here. Love is about your seeing my glory. That's bullet point number 13. A textual foundation for this definition of being loved. Being loved is not being spared from dying. Being loved is not mainly being healed, mainly the marriage being fixed. Those can be acts of love. God does those things. Being loved is mainly God doing whatever he has to do, whether it's Lazarus' death or his death, so that I will see, savor, and be satisfied by the glory of Jesus. That's love. Any other act that leaves me short of that may feel like love to a million unregenerate people, and it isn't. Love is when God gets you to God. Bullet point number 14. I want to go back a couple hundred years, 250 or so, to my mentor. My main mentors are all dead. There are a few living ones. My dad is still alive. Dan Fuller is still alive. Colleagues around me refine and sharpen my thinking, but most of my most influential mentors are dead. Most of them wrote this book. This is the Bible. A few of them, after the Bible, wrote things that were so profoundly shaping in my life. I will thank God through eternity for them. And the main one is Jonathan Edwards. Edwards had an effect on me, especially in his book, The End for Which God Created the World, and Religious Affections and Freedom of the Will. Those three books were the main powerhouses in my life about 30 years ago. I want to quote what we've just seen from Edwards, some of it. I'll close probably this afternoon with Edwards just to pay tribute to his influence in me. So Edwards, here's the situation. Jonathan Edwards was a pastor in New England, born 1703, died 1758, and was the main human spark plug of the first great awakening. And so he saw phenomenal conversions and signs and wonders and terrible abuses of all of that. And therefore, he struggled with sorting his way through the chaff and the wheat of what was real and what was not real in the Great Awakening. And his analysis in Religious Affections of the human heart are devastating. There were no evening services in Munich from 1971 to 1974 when Noelle and I and our little baby Karsten were in Munich, Germany studying. There were no evening services on Sunday. So what I did on Sunday evenings was sit in a rocking chair when my wife wasn't using it with baby Karsten and read the Religious Affections. It took me a year because I could only handle a page or two at a time. It was an absolutely devastating experience to read Jonathan Edwards' analysis of my heart. So here's just a couple of paragraphs. It's amazing that this same idolatry is sometimes even true when people thank God for sending Christ to die for them. There is a kind of thanks that is idolatrous. You can thank God in an unregenerate, idolatrous way, Edwards said. Perhaps you have heard people say how thankful we should be for the death of Christ because it shows how much value God puts upon us. In other words, they are thankful for the cross as an echo of our worth. What is the foundation of this gratitude? Jonathan Edwards calls it the gratitude of hypocrites. Why? Here's the quote. Because, quote, They first rejoice and are elevated with the fact that they are made much of by God. Then, on that ground, God seems, in a sort, lovely to them. They are pleased in the highest degree in hearing how much God and Christ make of them, so that their joy is really a joy in themselves and not in God. That, I fear, is in many churches today. That sounds so up to date, I cannot believe it. Jonathan Edwards, this is me again, learned this to his own heartache as he studied the permutations of hypocrisy in the fallout of the Great Awakening. Here's what he says. This is the difference between the joy of the hypocrite and the joy of the true saint. The hypocrite rejoices in himself. Self is the first foundation of his joy. The true saint rejoices in God. True saints have their minds in the first place inexpressibly pleased and delighted with the sweet ideas of the glorious and amiable nature of the things of God. This is the spring of all of their delights and the cream of all their pleasures. But the dependence of the affections of hypocrites is in a contrary order. They first rejoice that they are made so much of by God, and then on that ground, he seems in a sort lovely to them. There are many evangelistic church growth strategies today that are playing right into that hypocrisy. They simply take fallen people where they are, who love to be made much of, and they find ways of making God and the cross the means of affirming what they already are. Rather, what we offer to people is not a satisfaction of their own unregenerate desires to be at the bottom of their joy, but rather a call to recognize that's idolatry and that's suicidal. And by the way, we have something so much better. You can't even imagine it. It's so much better. We need to help people catch a glimpse of that. So bullet point number 14 was Jonathan Edwards. Number 15. Now this came out at the question and answer time last night in such a helpful way to me. Set my mind just whirring with effort to re-understand and re-explain. So I stayed up late rethinking and writing this little bullet point number 15. So here's the issue. You keep saying, Piper, that to be loved by God is not to be made much of by Him at bottom, but His making us able to enjoy making much of Him. That's what you keep saying, and that's exactly what I keep saying, and I still believe it after last night. However, clearly there are texts in the Bible where God makes much of us. Okay, so if you've been sitting here thinking, doesn't he know what's in the Bible? He keeps saying not that but this, and it's really, isn't it both? Or how does they fit together? So let me read you some of those texts. Zephaniah 3:17. The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. God rejoicing over us. Psalm 147 verse 11. The Lord takes pleasure in those who fear Him, in those who hope in His steadfast love. God takes pleasure in us. Kind of take your breath away and wonder how that fits with our being created to take pleasure in Him? 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7. In this salvation you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold, which though perishable is tested by fire, may redound. So there's a sampling. A sampling of texts in which the Bible uses the most lavish language of God rejoicing over us, praising us, commending us, thus making much of us. So, the question then becomes, what does that mean? How does He do that? And how does it fit together with everything I've said so far? So when you ask, does He love me, my personality? To answer that question, you have to ask what you mean by love, and there are two possible meanings, aren't there? One is agape, kind of unconditional, pursuing your good kind of love. And the answer to that is yes. Because He elected you unconditionally. He regenerated you unconditionally. You didn't have to do anything for those. He put Christ forward to die for you before you were born. So you didn't meet any conditions for that. And He exercises His sovereign keeping power on the basis, rooted in, that unconditional election, unconditionally. He's going to keep you. He will overcome every backsliding that you ever do and keep you for Himself. So yes, the personality that you are, God pursues for His glory and for your good. But that's not what most people mean when they say, does He love me? Most people, okay, they say. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people like this. They say, okay, I understand what you're saying. I was elected unconditionally. He's pursuing my good. I want to know, does He like me? I just want to know, does He like me? Now, that's the second kind of love. The second kind of love is, Edwards called it the love of complacence, the love of liking, approving, delighting. That's what these texts are saying. God does that. And the question is, on what basis? What does He like about us? Because the Bible is very clear, sometimes He likes us more and sometimes He likes us less. Otherwise, Paul wouldn't be able to talk about, I do everything I do in order to please Him. I want to please Him. Please, please. That means sometimes you're not pleasing Him and sometimes you are pleasing Him. And my question is simply, what's He pleased by? And my answer is, He's pleased by our being pleased by Him. He delights in our delighting in Him. He takes joy in us because of our taking joy in Him. That's the bottom line. Because if I try to find any other answer to the question, why He likes me, it resolves into that. I have to push it to that. You might say, He likes me because I'm good. Or He likes me because I do right things. Well, what does good mean? And what does right mean? And my answer is ultimately, everything you do with your mind in thinking, with your heart in feeling, and with your hands in doing and making, God may delight in, provided it's flowing from and expressing a satisfaction in Him. So the answer is yes. Yes. So I'm not going to back away from the centrality of God in God's love for me. He loves me in that He does everything He does to remove obstacles to my enjoyment of Him. And He delights in me, praises me, commends me, says well done to me, if and when my heart has broken free from the idolatry of needing to be at the bottom of my own joy and is willing to get out of the way, let God become the bottom of my joy, and then out of that fountain of delight in God, do all the things that I do in my life. Then God will say, well done, well done. That will be a reflection of his own worth.
This is Light and Truth, God-centered preaching to help you see Christ clearly and treasure him truly. I'm your host, Dan Kruver. Thank you for listening. On our next episode, John Piper continues our 8-part series, The Great Goal of the Gospel, with a message titled, The History of the Gospel. I hope you'll join us. For more resources, visit desiringgod.org.